Albert the Great, by the way, is not to be confused with Alfred the Great, who was the king of Wessex who fought the Vikings. So I don't want that confusion. Anyway, Thomas Aquinas today, and then some other great people. Aquinas, as it says here, there's his picture, there's the Holy Spirit giving him information. He was born, as it says, in 1225. It may be 1226, but we don't know. And you can see he died in 1274. He was born in the south of Italy, close to Monte Cassino, and he studied at the University of Naples, which I mentioned yesterday had been founded by Frederick II. He became a Dominican, and he studied both in Cologne in Germany and in Paris under Albertus Magnus. But after a brief period in Paris, he went back and spent most of his life in Italy. But he returned to Paris about 1270 because there was a great struggle in the Dominican faith at the time against what are called the Averroists. Averroes was a brilliant Muslim philosopher who lived in Cordoba in the early 12th century. What was picked up by Christians is not really very accurate from his writings, but nonetheless, this is what happens to people who write. Other people come along and misinterpret what they say. These Christian Aristotelian philosophers said that Aristotle insisted that the soul was not immortal, and that Aristotle was perfect and could not be contradicted. Everything he said was the truth, which is clearly nonsense. But the idea that the soul was not immortal was contrary to Catholic theology, and that was not right, and it brought Aristotle into considerable dispute and brought Aquinas, who was the greatest scholar of his age, to his defense. Aquinas had acquired a greater knowledge of Aristotle than anyone else at his time, and he rejected all these Platonic ideas, even though they had been expressed by St. Augustine. He wrote two great books, which I think I can translate the titles of from Latin, which are the Theological Consequences Against Gentiles and Theological Consequences or Conclusions. He considers what he meant, what is meant by the word wisdom, and he argues for the proven existence of God by reason. His purpose, he declares, is to declare the truth which the Catholic faith professes. He wants to appeal to reason because there are people who do not believe in the authority of the scripture, and he wants to try to convince them. Reason, he argues, can prove the existence of God, and it can prove the immortality of the soul. It cannot prove the Trinity or the Incarnation or the Last Judgment. And what he wants to do is prove those things which can be proved and differentiate them from those which he thinks cannot. Now, he uses an argument in his proof of God's existence, which is still used today, and I will come back to it later. This is an argument which arises first with Aristotle, and it's the argument of the unmoved mover. He says, and I'll quote, "Whatever is moved by something. And since an endless regress is impossible, we must arrive at something which moves other things without being moved itself. This unmoved mover is God." This idea that there's a beginning and therefore a beginner is around today just as strongly as it was in Aquinas' day and in Aristotle's day, and has been used with me numerous times by numerous people, and it comes from our application of common sense to the way in which things work, and our idea of causality and the idea that time is continuous. Science, unfortunately, is not common sense, and that's what makes it so hard to learn. And I always start courses to beginning physics students with the idea that we human beings have been around and smart as hell for 10 or 20,000 years. Science was invented 300 years ago. It took a long time, precisely because it's not common sense. It's a hard way of looking at the world. The idea of continuous time means there must have been something before the Big Bang. There must have been a beginning. But of course, the Big Bang is believed to have created both time and space. So there was no time, there was no before. You can't speak of what happened before the Big Bang because the word doesn't mean anything. Now, this is completely contrary not only to common sense, but to any sort of sense. It just doesn't, it's very hard to grasp because we've never seen anything like it, and it really is not sensible. The fact that it's probably true is immaterial to most of us. Also, the idea of an infinite regression is certainly something that's possible. For example, if you take the negative numbers starting with minus one, they never end. They go on forever and ever. You keep getting bigger and bigger negative numbers, or if you like, smaller and smaller numbers. This series of negative numbers was something that was completely unknown in Aquinas' time. Negative numbers did not exist. They had ones and five, V's and X's and L's and C's and M's and D's and all those things. They didn't have ones and twos and threes, which we'll come to in a bit. Whether Aquinas would have been affected by this idea, and no one can tell, of course. He goes on to list his five reasons for the existence of God. The first is the unmoved mover reason. The second is the argument of a first cause. There had to be a beginning. And this again depends on our common sense ideas. The third is that there must be a source of all necessity. That is, the things that must happen for a reason. And that reason, of course, is God. The fourth argument, which is a really interesting one, is that we find various perfections in the world, and perfections can only have been created by something perfect. Now, this argument was used in the 19th century against Darwinism because people would say, the human eye is perfect, and how could that happen by natural selection? Even Darwin himself was confused and worried by that argument. However, we now know, because things do progress and we do learn, hard as that is, that the human eye is far from perfect. There are lots of things like the position of the retina and the design of the lens and so forth that make the human eye far from perfect, and it could be a hell of a lot better had it been designed. Also, we have seen in fossils development stages of eyes that go from blindness through various stages of development. So we've learned. Aquinas's fifth reason is that we find that even lifeless things serve a purpose, and that must be something outside themselves, since only living things can create their internal purpose. He's a very brilliant reasoner or dialectician, and he also goes on to debate an idea which has troubled Plato and Aristotle and virtually everybody else. And this is an idea of universals. And it means, can God know only in eternal truths, or can God know particulars, such as the various things that go on in our that concern individuals and that individuals do? Christians who have the concept of free will and the intervention by God in the world have to believe that God knows particulars. So Aquinas, in his brilliance, lists seven reasons why God cannot know particulars, and then even more brilliantly goes on to refute each of them. The most interesting of these seven is the existence of evil in the world. And this troubles many religions and religious and irreligious people to this day. How can a beneficent God, who is perfect in every way, allow the slaughters that take place on our earth, including particularly the slaughters of innocent children, which we have seen so much of in our history? Now, Aquinas argues that in some events, in some singulars, as he calls them, there is evil. But God cannot know evil, but he can know evil things. And to know something is to know its opposite. And the opposite of an evil thing is a good thing. And he knows good things, so he must be able to know of the existence of evil things. I love that argument. I mean, he's such a smart guy. He argues, and this is an interesting one for Catholics, I think, he argues that the soul is immortal, but that it is created afresh in each person. It's not transmitted through the intercourse of parents, but is created by God afresh in every individual. Now, that's a problem, because if the soul is not transmitted from the parents, how does Adam's original sin get into each individual? Problem. And it bothered Augustine, and it's bothered a lot of Catholic theologians, and it didn't seem to bother Aquinas, who just ignored it. Much of what is expressed today, in certainly by the Vatican and in a lot of other religions, is contained in Aquinas, such as laws on divorce, birth control, incest, sin, predestination. His argument against divorce is a painful one. He argues that fathers are necessary for the raising of children. Okay, obvious. But why? Because fathers are more rational than mothers. No, I don't believe that for a second. If anything, I believe the inverse. He also argues that fathers are stronger than mothers, and therefore they can hit the kids harder if they need them. Now, as often as I mentioned with Aquinas, he starts out by refuting arguments he wants to support and then destroys them. He's a very clever arguer. But he is out to prove things he already believes. And his arguments lead to a known end. It's almost like what I described yesterday, teleology, where you know where you're going and you make arguments to get there. This is very unlike Socrates, for example, who followed arguments wherever they led. I think, myself, this makes Aquinas a very great theologian, but a lesser philosopher. Aquinas left Paris, and he returned to having destroyed the Averroists, and he returned to Naples in 1272. In 1273, apparently at prayer, he seems to have had a vision of Jesus. And Christ appeared and said something to him, and we don't know what, because he never wrote it down and never recorded it. But he stopped working and he stopped writing, and he said, "Everything I have written seems like straw to me." He had written over 1 million words by quill pen. That's not so easy. The following year, 1274, he was out riding on a donkey somewhere, banged his head on a branch of a tree. It was a very serious injury, and he died just short of 50 years old. He had done a hell of a lot of work in that time. Now, from Plato to Aquinas, the idea of God as the unmoved mover was dominant. But this was changed by Francis of Assisi. He preferred to view God as a person, rather than as a self-sufficient divine presence. His God made agreements with people the way he had done with the ancient Israelites. He acts rather than simply is. His greatest action of God was in becoming human in Jesus Christ. Francis wanted people to see the humanity of God so they would be better prepared to love and worship him. To emphasize this human aspect of God, Francis was the first to create a nativity scene with a stable and Mary and Jesus and the Magi and the animals. Now, these animals have been removed by church dogma because there's no proof of them, they're not mentioned in the Gospels. That hasn't taken them off the front of Christmas cards, of course. Now, this nativity scene led to one of my favorite paintings, which I will hear. This is from Giotto's painting in the Scrovegni Chapel in Padua. It's a mural, and you can see all of the... there's the Holy Family, there are the animals. the angels up here, and I don't know if those are the wise men or not. They don't have all that stuff that I see on Christmas cards, so maybe they're not. Dante was around in Padua at that time because he was had been exiled from Florence in one of these Guelph-Ghibelline disputes. And he saw this, and this picture had a great influence on the writing of the Divine Comedy. I want you just to notice something which I'm going to come back to about painting, that the positions of the figures and who's in the foreground and who's in the background, that's going to turn out to have some influence. Now, the emphasis by Francis on the suffering of Christ and the importance of Mary led to a more human and humane Christ and Mary. Mary is the suffering mother rather than as an impersonal archetype for queens and empresses. Aquinas had built a logical case in his wonderful way that the sufferings of Jesus on the cross were the greatest sufferings, the greatest pain of any human being ever in history. And this idea of the suffering Christ permeated both the Dominicans and the Franciscans, and it led to some wonderful art. It led particularly to Our Lady of Pity, or the Pietà, which we have seen both in statues and in paintings. However, this increased emphasis on pain and suffering led to an additional and unfortunate side effect, because if Christ suffered so horribly, then attention turned to who made him suffer so bad, and that attention turned to the Jews, who were considered further and further as really terrible by the Franciscans and suffered accordingly. But Augustine, long before, back in the 5th century, had written that God allowed Jews to survive all of their suffering as a warning to Christians, and that Jews should be allowed to survive and to practice their religion as a continued warning to Christians on how to behave. And God intended the conversion of the Jews to happen at the final judgment, not in the 14th century. So the irony here, I think, yet again, is that this great apostle of love, St. Francis, gave rise to an order which was the chief sustainer of anti-Semitism in medieval Europe. And it was in this atmosphere in England that the Parliament of Edward I, back in 1289, wouldn't raise funds for the king's wars until he expelled all of the Jews from England, and they weren't allowed back until Oliver Cromwell in 1656, almost 400 years later. Now, if I turn back to a little bit of real science, I want to start to talk about English people, and particularly Roger Bacon. Bacon seems to have been a famous name in science. We have Roger Bacon in the 13th century. We have Francis Bacon in the 17th century, and then there's the artist Francis Bacon in the 20th century. So there have been some fairly well-known people with that name. Now, Bacon was a Franciscan, and he studied at a man with whom I'd like to start, his teacher, who was at Oxford, and his name is Robert Grosseteste. Grosseteste, of course, means big head, Bob Big Head. And there's no evidence in paintings of him that his head was any larger than anybody else's. But that always sort of brings to mind this couplet from Oliver Goldsmith's Deserted Village: "The wonder grew that his small head could contain all it knew," because he was a very smart guy. He was the first chancellor of Oxford, and he was born about 1175, died about 1253. He was a mathematician, an astronomer, a physicist, a philosopher, a translator from Greek into Latin, etc., etc., etc. He started philosophical studies at Oxford. He insisted that Greek be a taught language, not just Latin, and had an influence in European thought that had lasted for several centuries. He based natural philosophy both on experimental sensory perception and on mathematics, and this was emphasized greatly by his best student, who we'll come to, is Roger Bacon. He was just as an aside, the first person in the Western world to note the precession of the equinoxes. The axis of the Earth defines for us north and south, and it points in a given direction in the heavens. But that's not constant. That axis of the Earth makes a very slow circle in the Earth, in the heavens. It takes about 26,000 years to go around. And that's primarily due to the gravitational pull of Jupiter on the Earth, as well as the major gravitational attraction of the Sun. How anybody in those days could measure a time period of 26,000 years, and even on Saturday I will mention that was done in 300 BCE, is remarkable to me. Now, his Greek must have been good, and I wanted to mention that because he was the first person to translate Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics into Latin from the Greek. And unlike Aristotle's work on the natural sciences, the way in which people think about how to treat other people hasn't really changed. It isn't very much, and it's a very great book, which I urge everybody to read if they can. His career fell into two parts, first as a professor at Oxford, and then second as the Bishop of Lincoln in England. To the first part belongs his commentaries on Aristotle and then the Bible, and in the second part his translations from the Greek. He was the person who brought Aristotle into university curricula, and for him, and I want to talk about his science for just a minute. The fundamental thing in the universe was light, which he called lux from the Latin. This light spread out from a single point, which was like the Big Bang, and started and spread out in a gigantic sphere, decreasing as it went, so that the universe was denser in the middle and got less dense as we went out. For some reason, it reached a boundary and reflected back in a way called that he called reflected light, or he called it lumen. So he had lux going out, lumen coming back, and this reflected light bounced back and created the individual spheres which had all the seven heavens of Aristotelian cosmology. In all of his writings, however, he made it very clear that lux and lumen were not what we would call visible light, which was only one of its manifestations, but rather was a vital power, what he called a virtus, from what we get the English word virtue, varying in its manifestation according not only to the course, to the source from which it was propagated, but also to the influence it had on the recipient. For example, solar radiation, he said, we can not only keep us warm, but can transfer water from a liquid into a vapor. And that's what he means by such things. He talked about the tides being caused by rays from the moon that caused vapors to rise up from the bottom of the sea and push the sea up, and then they expanded up into the air, and then the sea fell back down. It's lovely, fanciful stuff, but it's interesting that he's thinking about these problems. It was left to his most brilliant student, Roger Bacon, to continue his work on optics and physics. And on the calendar, which was a continual struggle for Christians. Albertus Magnus continued a lot of his work on philosophy, and John Duns Scotus continued much of his work on the physics. His European reputation became very significant following the printing press and had a significant influence on the Englishman Thomas Hobbes. Goethe Testa's best student, of course, as I said, was Roger Bacon. Bacon was born around 1219, died about 1292. He had studied in Paris alongside Albertus Magnus, but underwent a radical intellectual change when he came back to Oxford and studied under Robert Goethe Testa. The Franciscans at this time were splitting into two branches, and Bacon represented one very strong branch. I think I mentioned that there was always a tendency of Franciscans, as opposed to Dominicans, to believe in Augustine and this Neoplatonic philosophy stuff about ideals and perfection and so forth. And there was a branch of that which continued such. But there was a second branch represented by Bacon that was really alive to all the mathematical, physical, astronomical, and medical writings of Aristotle. And the influence, this was the time when he was alive, when the influence of Averroes was at its strongest in Europe. And this, as I mentioned, this great deterministic view of the universe considered Aristotle as perfect. Until the Dominicans, such as Albertus Magnus and Aquinas, destroyed that kind of deterministic viewpoint. It was Grosseteste, Aquinas, and Albertus who made Aristotle acceptable to Christianity. But this was a time of great intellectual turmoil, and intellectual turmoil, as still happens today, leads to censorship, and there was great censorship at the time. This did not bother Bacon very much, but for reasons I've not been able to discover, the Pope, Clement, asked Bacon to send him a copy of his writings, which I can understand, he was curious, but to do so in a secretive manner, and I haven't been able to discover why Bacon's work had to be secret. I'm not sure, maybe because he was a Franciscan and Aquinas was dominating the stage. Still, Bacon did so, and this got, when his superiors in the Franciscan order discovered this, this got him into a fair amount of trouble. Now, despite the turmoil in Franciscans, it didn't have seem to have much effect on Bacon's life. But then suddenly, in 1278, he was put in prison for writing stuff, and he stayed there until 1292, when he died. The greater disturbance, however, was not in England, but was rather on the continent, because Francis was a mendicant, I mean, and he was a beggar in these mendicant orders. But by the 13th century, the Franciscans had priories and money, and so they were split into two groups. There were the people who wanted to be more like the Dominicans and have stuff, and then there were the people called the spiritualists, who wanted to go back to Francis's original ideas. Now, already in 1215, the whole idea of a mendicant order had been condemned by the Lateran Council, I think I mentioned yesterday, in 1215. This split, actually, in Christianity is incredibly old. It began with St. Paul. That's how old it is. And St. Paul consciously rejected the poverty of Christ when he went around to Greece and Rome to spread the word. And it is to Paul that we owe what is often called in English the Puritan ethic, the value of hard work and the fact that the pride you get in the reward for working like hell, even if you don't make money. So he calls Jesus' poverty a privilege rather than an obligation. Spiritualists, the spiritual branch of the Franciscans, were finally condemned by Pope Innocent in 1290, and their foundation was burnt in 1300 as a heretic, along with lots of others of these guys. The spiritualists had, and I just mentioned, had been influenced heavily by an 11th century Italian Cistercian monk named Joachim of Fiore, and I certainly remember at university back in the 60s that he suddenly attained, and I don't know why, a lot of popularity. And even I have a book of his somewhere on a shelf unread for the last 40 years, probably. The quarrels were very serious, the political quarrels. The kings, the Pope, the Emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor, they were fighting all the time, and there were lots of problems. And this period of intense competition has also been called the period of the papal of the Babylonian exile, and this is in a reference to the exiles of the Jews from Jerusalem to Babylon in 587 BCE. The death of Boniface VIII, who was a very controversial pope, resulted in the election of a French prelate, Celestine. And there were such struggles going on in Rome at the time that he stayed instead in France. He went to Avignon so he could be under the protection of the king, the French king at that time. Well, this led to the popes for the next several decades staying in Avignon, and there was the Avignon papacy, which I called the Babylonian exile. Many of the struggles that people were undergoing at this time seemed, and they were deadly serious, because people killed each other over them. They seem awfully silly to us, such as, could angels in heaven actually see the face of God or not? That doesn't strike me as a reason for killing your neighbor, but it obviously mentioned mattered. But so bitter were the feelings that the Franciscan William of Ockham condemned the Pope as a heretic, and the Pope returned the favor by condemning all of Ockham's writing and excommunicating him. Bacon's greatest claim to fame was his emphasis on the experimental spirit. He saw clearly and better than anyone else at his time that without mathematics and without doing experiments, that natural philosophy was only talk, only verbiage. Bacon was a poorer philosopher than Aquinas, but he was a far better scientist. He was a poorer naturalist than Albertus, but a better mathematician and a better physicist. He was a much more encyclopedic thinker than any of those people. He had a remarkable imagination, and he vaguely foresaw all sorts of amazing things. He saw the possibility of circumnavigating the globe. He saw the propulsion of boats by mechanical means rather than by rowers. He imagined flying, of taking advantage of the explosive powers of gunpowder, which had recently been introduced into Europe, and of improving sight by using of lenses. And this work was followed very shortly by the first spectacles ever, which were made in Italy sometime in the 14th century, and made a huge difference as people like me can actually see where they're going as they get older. He is regarded as the true harbinger of modernity, while Aquinas, apart from his church reputation, is just relegated as a medieval scholastic thinker. His writings about flight are particularly interesting because apparently he knew of a Benedictine monk named Aylmer back in the 11th century who flew. And he flew in a glider, and this is recorded by a lot of people, so it may actually be true, and it's taken quite seriously by historians. He had a glider which went about 600 meters, and it then crashed, and he broke both his legs, and was quite known to be very lame in his old age. And this led Bacon to say the following: a machine revolving some engine, but he still had flapping wings. I mean, the idea of birds was very strong. I've not seen one, but I know a wise man who has designed one. I think that refers to Aylmer, and he read about it. Machines for navigation can be made without rowers. This is, we're now talking 1300 and something. That's not bad. There's the Ferrari for you. Bacon made experiments with mirrors and lenses, and he vaguely foresaw, yet again, inventions such as the compound microscope and the telescope, even though it was several hundred years away. Using measurements with the astrolabe, he made a remarkable discovery that the center of a rainbow and the person's eye and the sun were in a straight line. That's true. if you look at a rainbow ever, you will notice the sun over your shoulder. That's even, okay. That's why you can never get to the end of the rainbow. That's why there's a pot of gold there, because you just can't get it. He was really imbued with the Platonic idea of the importance of mathematics and arithmetic, and said that the best source of knowledge apart from revelation must include experimentation complemented by mathematical analysis. This is what we mean by mathematical physics today. It's a remarkable thing. Now, I want to come to one of my great heroes, who is Leonardo of Pisa. His father had a surname of Bonacci, so in Italian he would be the son of Bonacci, or the figlio di Bonacci, and or, to be short, Fibonacci. Leonardo Fibonacci was born he was older than Bacon, born about 1170 and died about in 1240. In his day, Pisa was a major naval power, and it had trade throughout the Mediterranean. His father was in charge of customs in a town called Bugia, which is in Algeria today. And his father brought his son Leonardo over to help him with all the stuff. And there he met a Muslim mathematician who taught him about numbers. Now, he was a very, very smart guy and a great mathematician. He traveled throughout North Africa and into Syria and brought all of this knowledge back to Europe. He introduced mathematics seriously into Europe, particularly the Hindu Arabic numerals, which we generally just shorten to Arabic numerals, even though they were invented in India. He was the finest Christian mathematician of the Middle Ages, and his book called Liber Abaci is not just a book about the abacus, but it's a book about that greatest contribution, I think, of Arabic mathematics, algebra, into Europe. By 14, here is a picture of numerals. These are the ones that exist in the Middle East. These are the ones that exist in Europe. I like this one, which I discovered in 5, which I discovered. By the way, in Farsi, this is penta. So that's where the Greeks get that. But in Farsi people, I saw, drew this as a heart. I rather like that. In the school of a Dominican preacher named Nemerarius, and I don't think I wrote him down because nobody knows when or about when he lived or died, there were a lot of very important developments going on in the study of motion. Next to Fibonacci, Nemerarius was probably the greatest mathematician of the Middle Ages. And he showed in particular that motion could be taken apart into perpendicular components, so that if you consider a projectile, which goes like that, it could be broken up into a horizontal motion and the vertical motion, which is due to gravity. This is very different than what Aristotle said, which is it goes like that and then runs out of force and then goes like that, which you can see with your eyes is rubbish, but that doesn't mean you don't believe it. His ideas about this were applied to all sorts of objects on inclined planes, and they were used extensively by Leonardo da Vinci in the 15th century. Now, aside from gravity, the only other motive force that was known in the world at the time was magnetism, and William Gilbert wrote the definitive book on magnetism in 1600. It's called On Magnetism, or De Magneti, because it's written in Latin. And he is the father of magnetism. But he clearly attributed, because he was a good guy, his death to a much earlier book called Letters on Magnetism, or Epistola de Magneti, that was written by a man named Petrus Peregrinus in 1269. The attractive property of lodestones, of rocks, were known as early as recorded by Thales back in 600 BCE. It's a long time ago. And the use of these things to make a compass was well known to the Chinese. And the compass was clearly used before 1200 as a means to aid navigation. Peregrinus made a lot of interesting experiments. For instance, if you take a wire and it's magnetic, and it's got a north pole at one end and north pole at one end and a south pole at the other end, and you break it in half and you get two pieces, but each piece is a magnet and there's a north pole, south pole. So where there wasn't a pole in the middle, when you break it, it appears. Okay. He knew that, and he had done that experiment. Chemistry existed in the 13th century, but it was really involved with alchemy, and therefore not much of much use. Alchemy, by the way, arose in Egypt, and it came from people who were doing metal work in the Nile Valley. These were a combination of people who had Gnostic and Neoplatonic ideas about how things work. And it started back about the 3rd century of this common era. And the name comes from metalworking in Egypt, which in Greek is chemeia, and which comes originally from the Greek word for black, which is chemi. And that comes apparently, I like all this etymology stuff, it comes originally from the black soil of the Nile, which is so fertile. And this word, of course, chemi, led to the Arabic alchemy and then to the English chemistry. In popular imagination, all alchemy was about was the turning of lead into gold, but that's really rubbish, and that's not what people were interested in at all. There weren't a lot of advances, perhaps, in chemistry, but there were a lot of advances made in distilling. And the first mention of making distilled spirits from wine is in a 12th century manuscript in Italy. 60% alcohol was being distilled, and then aqua vita, which is 96% alcohol, was also being made. And I remember aqua vita because we students used to swipe it from chemistry labs to put in punch at parties. I never got caught, fortunately. I didn't do that, my friends did that. But by the end of the 13th century, alcohol was an important substance as a solvent for perfumes, for extracting medicine, and of course for drinking. Magic made its way into alchemy as well, with a search for a formula for eternal youth and infinite eternal life. And this led to the medieval growth of the legends of Dr. Faustus. In the 13th century, there was a lot of discussion and controversy at the time which the soul entered the fetus. Dante advocated a theory of Augustine and of Averroes that the soul was generated along with the body, but only manifested with the first movement of the fetus. In medicine, there was Galen's work had been discovered, and this determined a great deal of what happened in medical terms in those times. Books on surgery, because dissection began, and so people started to write books on surgery, in the 13th and in the 14th century, there finally appeared a book on anatomy rather than on surgical procedures. And this led to lots of books about how to dissect corpses. The universities at Bologna and at Padua, and particularly the medical school in Montpellier in France, made significant contributions to our understanding of anatomy in those days. This led to these incredible anatomical drawings of Da Vinci in the 15th century, and eventually to the great work on anatomy, which was published by Vesalius in 1543 in Padua, the exact same year that Copernicus published his great work and died. Now, for the 13th century, though, the position of human beings was absolutely central in the world, very special. We were the purpose and the final product of material creation and the center of the scale of creatures. We stood at the apex of material beings, but at the base of spiritual ones. Our souls came directly from God, and they were created with the idea of being eternal, for eternal life. Because of this special place that we occupied, we, before all creatures, were in the right place to pray to and praise and believe in God. But the and if you like, to praise the Lord. And this attitude of the church is absolutely crucial, because this view made possible these investigations, these looking into ways to describe humans and the nature as the creations of God, and meant to in terms of the praise of God. This was the sentiment of Grosseteste, Testa, of Bacon in England, as well as Aquinas and Albertus in Paris and in Germany and in Italy, and among all the orders of friars who developed science in the 13th century. It was absolutely crucial. By the end of the 13th century, there were very few people who believed that Aristotle had the answers to how the universe worked. But he did provide a framework for scientific thought, and insisting, and the Christian theologians insisted that God must be independent of any restrictions whatsoever. Aristotle, for example, said that motions required pushes and pulls all the time, and this was questioned and changed along with time. One of the things that occurred at Oxford amongst this school of Aristotelians was a change to expressing physical units in physical terms, in abstract units, if you like, the introduction of x into equations, which came surely from Fibonacci's introduction of algebra into Europe. The transmission of knowledge from one university to another was helped a great deal by the fact that people started to standardize units so that they could talk to one another about the sizes of things. The mechanical clock came into being at the end of the 13th century. And this was very important because it took temporal events, time, and changed them into spatial ones, the position of hands on a clock. That was an important thing. And now I come back to painting, which I mentioned when we looked at Giotto, because this changed painting a great deal. Previously, in early medieval painting, figures were placed according to their theological importance. But you notice there that Mary was not at the, and Jesus were not at the front of the painting, and by the early 14th century, canvases were divided, or whatever they were painting on, were divided up into geometric checkerboards, and perspective was being used for the first time. Maps appeared with good divisions of latitude and longitude, latitude being pretty easy to get, longitude never being a solved problem until the invention of John Harrison's clock in the 18th century. Commerce changed from barter to coinage, eventually to letters of credit and bills of exchange. All of these required calculations, interest, discounts, monetary exchange rates, bills of exchange. Trying to do that with X's and V's and I's and L's, it's hard enough to do addition, but multiplication, I mean, forget it. People multiplied by adding, and that's fine if you're multiplying by 2, but it's hell if you're multiplying by 23. Systematic units based on pieces of iron started to replace things like the span and the foot, which even in the back as early as the time of Richard the Lionhearted in England, that had started. Even the study of the music, and I've mentioned somewhere, I hope, that university study was divided up into a 3-part trivium and a 4-part quadrivium, and music harmony was part of the quadrivium along with astronomy. And to my delight, I found out that the scale that we use, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, etc., that's from the 11th century, and with the exclusion of do, which is ut, U-T in German, for example, ut, re, what is it? Ut, re, three, etc., whatever they have there on. Those come from the first six lines, the first syllables of the first six lines of a hymn to John the Baptist. Quite a remarkable thing, I thought. Anyway, that's just one of these trivia that one comes across. By the mid-14th century, really complex polyphony had entered music, and you can see this if you visit churches of the time, because you will notice that there are often two organs in a church placed on opposite sides of the nave. And if you ask a guide why, they generally, in my experience, had no idea. But the reason was polyphony requires two organs to play, and they did at the same time. Incredibly complex music. In the late 12th and throughout the 13th century, the great cathedrals were being built throughout Europe. And we don't know how much of this work was done by trial and error and how much was based on empirical science, although we do know that Nemerarius was doing a lot of calculations on static loads. Still, cathedrals such as Beauvais collapsed in whatever year it was, 1284. But there was a great desire to have high cathedrals and thin walls so you could cut holes in them and have stained glass windows. And this is why we have the pointed arch that starts to appear in Gothic, in so-called Gothic architecture, because it reduces the thrust of the ceiling of the roof down on the walls. And the weight of the ceiling pushes the walls out and makes things collapse. This occurred in the late 11th century in France, and they added ribs to, here are different, this is different sorts of vaults, and here you can see ribs occurring. Now, there's a rib vault, as the French used, but the English did not do that. They did not use rib vaults, they used fan vaults, and this led to the phenomenal things such as at King's College with the English fan vault ceiling, which are so beautiful. But they had to put extra ribs in there because they didn't point the arches quite so much. And the most striking device at the time was the invention of the flying buttress used in the Ile-de-France in the Cathedral of Notre-Dame and in Chartres, which pushes the walls in to keep them from collapsing. Military uses of technology were and always are important. Explosive saltpeter seemed to have been known to the Chinese about 100 of the common era. But the combination of saltpeter with sulfur and charcoal to make gunpowder didn't seem to occur to them till about 1000. Europe, and then into Europe about this, in the 13th century, cannon were used by the English at the Battle of Crecy in 1346. Weapons demanded the construction of cannon, and they were made in those days by taking strips of iron, putting them into a rough shape, and then putting bands of iron around them to keep them from blowing up. But this emphasis and the more modern way of making cannon, such as taking a billet of stuff and then drilling out a hole, that didn't occur until the 16th century. And eventually that led to the discovery by Lord Rumford about the beginning of the 18th century, beginning of the late 18th century, of the true nature of heat. But the whole, in terms of technology, all of this warfare led to improvements in metallurgy and then in mining and then in the water pumps to get the water out of mines and so forth. A medical school at Salerno was in operation as early as the 11th century in the Monte Cassino Monastery of Benedict, but was really eclipsed by the fact that medical schools grew rapidly in universities. First in Montpellier in southern France, and then in Bologna, and in Padua, and then in Paris, And these teachings were primarily based on Galen and on Hippocrates. But they were modified by the newer writings of various Arab and Jewish doctors from Spain, whose works were, of course, also now translated, particularly books by the great Persian doctor Avicenna, and then also by Isaac Israeli's classical work on fever, which describes such diseases as smallpox, measles, etc. Galen's theory was based on four humors in the body, blood, bile, phlegm, yellow bile, and black bile, dry, cold, wet, hot, etc. He had lots of things about herbs and drying drugs, the herbs to cool fevered patients, whatever other drugs. They even were able to make simple anesthesia, is the word I'm looking for, simple anesthesia for surgery. Whether that worked very well, I have my doubts. Anyway, they were really quite good at recognizing diseases, but they were not good at all at curing any diseases. The Black Death in the 14th century, with all its incredible horrors, did lead to some improvements. This plague seemed to come from India sometime around 1332. It spread westward, and it arrived in ports, Constantinople, Genoa, Naples, etc., by about 1347. It reached a climax in the Mediterranean region by 1348, then in the north of Europe a year later, and lastly in Russia in 1352. And it recurred in smaller epidemics for the next couple of centuries, in particular in England in 1664, a very notable year, because it drove Isaac Newton, a young student at that time, out of Cambridge, back to his mother's farm, where he wasted the next 2 years discovering the theory of gravity, physics, and calculus. Not bad for a kid. And of course, the plague in London was ended by the Great Fire of 1666, which burnt up all the rats, although nobody knew that. One of the outcomes of the plague was the understanding of the transmission of disease by contagion, which had been unknown to Galen and the Greeks. And this started with a work on leprosy, spread the smallpox, influenza, diphtheria, and typhoid. All of these were common and serious diseases. Back in the 12th century, leprosy was so common that one person in every 200 was a leper. That's staggering. There were, of course, as I said, no cures. And so when the plague broke out, the only way to escape it was to get the hell out and flee. But from Grossetesta to Galileo, the works of Aristotle were the dominant system and the ways in which people had thought about nature. There was the introduction of the great Greek mathematicians, Euclid, Apollonius, Heraclitus, and so forth. The use of induction, which, if you like, is educated guesswork, and experiment, and on the role of mathematics in explaining physical phenomena. An awful lot has been written, amongst others by Professor George Ellis here in Cape Town, on the apparent fact that the physical universe speaks to us in the language of mathematics. And there was a famous physicist of the 20th century, "This is a miracle we neither understand nor deserve." The impetus given to mathematics was due to this translation of Greek text, particularly those mathematicians I just mentioned. It was Aristotle's ideas of space, time, and motion that were most radically criticized from the 14th century on that eventually resulted in Galileo overthrowing the entire edifice of his science. But the Greek idea from the 12th century on was rational explanation, as in a formal or geometric proof. And this was allowed by the church. I cannot emphasize that enough. It is due to the church's attitude, which is generally denigrated amongst a lot of people, that science was allowed to develop. And it was due primarily to the influence of Thomas Aquinas, who made Aristotle consistent with Christian theology and therefore acceptable. It was only by the 13th century that mathematics in the West became a serious subject, and that was due primarily to Fibonacci, who gave the greatest impulse to mathematics with his introduction of that fantastic and my favorite subject at school, algebra. He was himself a very great mathematician, well beyond the Fibonacci sequence that bears his name. He understood negative numbers as a debt, and he was involved with the solving of what are called quartic and cubic equations, those which occur with powers of x to the 3 and x to the 4. There were great improvements made in arithmetic, and they were important, particularly in the growth of banking and commerce, where modern methods of multiplication and division were invented, double-entry bookkeeping was invented, questions of partnership, exchange, compound interest, discount, etc. For the first time, medieval Latin Christians learned to distinguish between false and true, between defective and complete ideas. The development of the inductive side of science, which is so important, as a result of experiment and observation, the ability to say, well, I think perhaps the reason this thing happens is because, etc. This was accomplished mostly within the confines of the church by friars who were the faculty of the universities. Tomorrow we'll see where that led, and then see to the fact that we no longer believe it. But thank you very much.